Okay, we are recording. Good morning. As one of a constant custom, or one of the constant customs that our sages instituted, as a constant reminder, a zecher l'churban, a reminder of the destruction, a constant custom of mourning to be observed, the entire year, Chazal instituted, our sages instituted, that when one sees the Arei Yehuda, the cities of Judah, Yerushalayim, the holy city, or the Makom HaMikdash, the place where the temple stood, in a state of churban, one rends their garment. We'll see the source for that in just a moment. But today, Yerushalayim is not in a state of churban. It's not bechurbanah. It's not laid in ruin. With over 500,000 Jewish residents, Jerusalem is teeming with life. Her skies lined with new buildings as the city continues to grow by leaps and bounds. And following the miraculous birth of the state of Israel and the dramatic reclamation of Jerusalem and the Temple Mount, this question of kriya, of observing this custom of mourning, the Churban, became the subject of much discussion and debate. And later on, following the Oslo Accords, and then again, following the disengagement, scholars would once again debate the status of territories and cities under the administration of the Palestinian Authority, and whether or not kriya, or rending one's garment, is warranted. At the heart of the controversy, we'll see, is the question of how we define Churban. How do we define ruin or destruction? And how the political reality impacts on the halacha. So we'll begin with a braita that appears at the top of your source sheets. It also appears at the top of Moed Katan Daf Chav Vav Amud Aleph. Okay? I hope everyone can see the source sheets. Let me just make sure. Here. Okay. I trust everyone can see the source sheets. So the Braita begins, Ve'elu kira'in she'in mitachin. These are the tears that cannot be permanently repaired. As you know, for a parent, when one rends their garment, they can never permanently repair that tear. For one of the shar krovim, one of the other relatives, after 30 days, the tear can be permanently repaired. Okay, now the Gemara at the end of this amud, at the end of the sugya, will say that even for one of these categories, you can perform some sort of imperfect repair or temporary repair. The Gemara says that it's permissible to the kulan rishain l'sholilan v'limolilan l'kotan l'asotan kimin sulamot. You can perform a crude type of repair. You can baste them. You can make them like sulamot, like literally like a ladder. Okay, you can tear that. You can repair the tear, but not in a permanent way. Like is the din for a parent, as I mentioned. And then the Braita continues, Hakore alaviv alimo, when one rends for a father or mother, as we've mentioned, the al rabo she limdo Torah, and for one's teacher who taught him Torah. That is a debate in the Gemara and Masechet Bava Mitzia, in Perek Elu Mitziot, if we're talking about one's Rebbe Muvhak, one's rabbi who taught him the majority of his chokhmah, of his wisdom, Rov Chachmato, or just even a rabbi who taught him Mishnah Achat, one Mishnah. You heard a Dvar Torah from someone. Here we assume that it's the former, that one rends for one's Rebbe, one's personal mentor and rabbi, one's Rebbe Muvhak. The Al Nasi Al Beit Din, and the Nasi, the president of the Sanhedrin and the Av Beit Din, the head of the Sanhedrin, okay, the chief justice, if you will. There are, Gemara discusses unique customs of mourning that are observed for the Nasi, for the Av Beit Din. When a leader of Klal Yisrael dies, we shut everything down. There's a seger. We close the yeshivot, Gemara says. We close the Batei Knesset. We close the Batei Midrash. Everyone gets together and mourns the loss. And in a similar vein, everyone tears like you would for a parent. You know, here your parent brings you into the physical world, Chazal teach. So your rabbi or the rabbi of Klal Yisrael bring you into the spiritual world. Okay, the parent-child relationship is often compared to the teacher-student relationship. Shinatim levanecha, banecha elu talmidecha. Va'al shmuot haraot, one hears exceedingly bad news, one rends their garment. Okay, Mordechai hears about what's going on in Shushan, how Haman wants to destroy the Jewish nation. He rends his garment. So when one hears exceptionally bad news, one also rends their garment. The Brayta continues, Al Birkat Hashem, when one hears literally the name of God blessed, but this, of course, is the intent is the opposite. We're talking about one who, God forbid, curses God. It's Lashon Sagi Nahor, okay? The language is ironic here. It means the opposite. Not someone who blesses God, but one who curses God. If one hears someone curse God, he is obligated to rend his garment. Va'al Sefer Torah Shenisraf, if one witnesses a Torah scroll being burned, one rends his garment. And the Brayta continues, and this is important for our discussion this morning, Va'al Arei Yehuda, and upon the cities of Judah, Va'al HaMikdash, and upon the temple, or where the temple stood, Va'al Yerushalayim, and on Jerusalem. We're talking about one who witnesses these three places, the cities of Judah, and the Makom HaMikdash, and Yerushalayim, in a state of Churban, in a state of destruction. V'kore al Mikdash, Mosif al Yerushalayim. The Brayta continues that one rends for the Mikdash, and he adds for Yerushalayim. And we'll explain what that means in just a moment. Now, it's interesting, there's a comparison here between these other categories, like rending one's garment for one's teacher, when hearing bad news, when seeing a Torah being burned, when witnessing the city of Yerushalayim, the Makom HaMikdash, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in a state of Korban. There's a comparison to one's parents here. So there's a machloket between the Rambam and the Ravid and the Ramban, whether there's a full comparison here or the comparison is just limited to repairing one's garment. In other words, as we've mentioned, one is not allowed to ever repair one's garment for a parent fully in a permanent way. Can't bring it to the tailor and have them completely sew it up. But there are other laws related to one's parent. If you look, for instance, earlier in the Masechet on Daf Chaf Dalet, the Gemara there talks about differences between one's parent and other types of relatives, other types of the Krovim, where we say that for one's parent, one has to tear ad shegalet libo, until he, you know, he reveals his heart, until he reveals his heart. There's a discussion as to what exactly that means. Is it the length of the tear? Is it the depth of the tear? The Gemara also says that one has to rip through all of their garments for a parent, whereas for another relative, one just has to rip the beged elyon, his outermost garment. Also, where does one begin to tear? What part of the garment does one begin to tear? So there are a lot of halachot and dinim unique to rending for a parent. And so the question is here, are we making a full comparison? Are we saying that all of the laws related to rending for one's parent apply equally to rending for one's teacher, or when hearing bad news, when hearing someone curse God's name, or when seeing a Torah being burned, when witnessing the cities of Judah and the temple and Yerushalayim in a state of destruction? So that's the machloket, where the Rambam assumes that all of the dinim apply equally. Others, the Ravid and the Ramban, limit it, no, just to repairing one's garment. Because again, that's how the Brayta begins. These are the tears that one cannot repair fully. And then the Brayta ends that they can repair these tears, or the Gemara really ends at the end of the Sukkia, that they can repair these tears in a temporary type of way. So that's how the Ravid and the Ramban read the Gemara. But in any case, the Gemara continues and provides psukim for how we know that there's an obligation to rend one's garment in these different situations. So skip here, I'll highlight the text. The Gemara asks, Arei Yehuda min elam. The Gemara wants to know, how do we know that one is obligated to rend his garment when seeing the cities of Judah in a state of destruction, or Yerushalayim with a Makom HaMikdash? Okay, so the Gemara asks, Arei Yehuda min elam. From where do we know that you have to rend your garment when seeing the cities of Judah in a state of Churban? Okay, what's the proof text? Dichtiv, And the Gemara here brings a pasuk from Sefer Yirmiyahu, Perek Mem Aleph, the 41st chapter of Jeremiah, that says, Vayavo anashim, there were people, there were men that came, Mishchem Mishilo, Umishomron, they came from the north, from the cities of Shchem, Shiloh, Shomron, Shmonim Ish, they were 80 men altogether, Migulchei Zakan, and they were clean shaven. We'll see why that's important in a moment, why the Navi has to tell us that. Ukru'ei Begadim, but their garments were torn. Umit Goredim, and they had made marks in their flesh, which is actually interesting. I'm not going to get into it now, because that's a real question. The Torah says, Lotit Goredu, you're not allowed to make a mark in your flesh upon hearing the news of a death in the family, or as an expression of grief, right? We tear the garment, but we don't make a permanent mark in our flesh. Right? That's what the pagans would do. That's what the Ovdei Avodah Zarah would do. And maybe that's what the Navi is describing, because these are people coming from the northern kingdom, people coming from Shiloh and Shechem and Shomron, where this was, of course, after the civil war, after the split in the kingdom, where you had the northern kingdom, the Malchut Yisrael, and the southern kingdom, Malchut Yehuda. Okay, and these are people that are coming towards Yerushalayim, and they have in their hands mincha ulvona biadam. They have in their hands gifts for the Beit HaMikdash. They have offerings, a mincha offering. They have frankincense, lehavi Beit Hashem, etc., to bring to the house of God. Okay, so the pshat is that these people, they did not know that the temple had been destroyed. Again, the fact that they made a mark in their flesh is already telling, right? They're coming from the northern kingdom, which they were worshiping Avodah Zarah. As you know, Ahav, the wicked king, prevented people from coming to Yerushalayim, to the Beit HaMikdash, and sentries posted there. In fact, we will celebrate on Tu B'Av. One of the causes to celebrate on Tu B'Av is that the sentries that were placed preventing people from being Ola L'Regel were finally removed. Okay, so the Northern Kingdom, they were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and they were and maybe that's why the Navi describes them as they were mitgoredim, and had marks in their flesh. But in addition to that, they hadn't heard that the temple had been destroyed. So these people are coming with gifts to the Holy Temple, and it's no longer there. So Rashi there explains that's why they were clean shaven, because they did not know that the Holy Temple had been destroyed. Okay? And the way Rashi understands the verse there in his comments to Sefer Yirmiyahu, they rend their garments upon hearing the news of the destruction of the temple. And that's why there's this stark contrast. On the one hand, they're clean shaven. On the other hand, they have torn garments and they're observing customs of mourning and they've made marks in their flesh. That's because they've heard of the awful news of the destruction of the Holy Temple. But the way the Gemara is using this verse here is slightly different. The Gemara is using this verse to suggest that they're on their way to the Holy Temple, to the Beit HaMikdash, with these gifts, with these offerings. And they encounter the Arei Yehuda. They first encounter the cities of Judah, and that's when they rend their garment. Okay, so the Gemara uses this as a proof text to explain why there's an obligation to rend your garment when seeing the Arei Yehuda in a state of Churban. Then the Gemara continues, Amar Bichelbo, Amar Ula Bira, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Haroet Arei Yehuda, Haroet Arei Yehuda b'Churbanan. Omer, a person who sees the cities of Judah in a state of destruction, should say, and this is a verse from the book of Yeshayahu, from the 64th chapter there, okay, they should say upon rending their garment, Arei Kotshecha Hayu Midbar v'Korea, they should say, your holy cities have become a wilderness, and they should rend their garment. Yerushalayim b'Churbanah, they encounter Jerusalem in a state of destruction, they should say, it's the same verse, it's a continuation. Tzion midbar haita Yerushalayim shmama. Tzion has become a wilderness, Jerusalem is empty, it's shmama, it's desolate, it's a wasteland, and then they should rend their garment. Beit HaMikdash b'churbano, and if they see the holy temple or the site where the temple stood in a state of destruction, okay, Omer, one says, Beit Kodshenu v'tifarteinu asher hilucha avoteinu haya l'sreifat esh v'kol machmadenu haya l'charba d'koreah. They, again, same, the continuation of the verse, they say the temple of our holiness and our splendor, where our fathers said Hallel and praised you, has become a fiery conflagration, okay, a fiery furnace. It's been burned down, l'sreifat esh, and all that we have desired has become churba, ruin, destroyed. Okay, and then they rend their garment. And then the Gemara continues, Udiminhu, but wait a minute. We have a question. We have a question from another Braita, a conflicting Braita. Echad ha-shomea ve-echad ha-roeh, kevan shigye letzofim, korea. The korea al migdash bifnei atzmo, the al Yerushalayim bifnei atzma. Whether one hears or whether one sees, okay? When he gets to Tzofim, what is Tzofim? Maybe it's Har HaTzofim, a place where he could see the Makom HaMikdash, right? When it was prohibited to get close to the Kotel, to get close to Har HaBayit, people would go to Har HaTzofim, different points in Jewish history. All right, there's that famous song, Me'al Pisgat Har HaTzofim. They would go to the Tzofim and look, a place that overlooked Yerushalayim, a place that overlooked Har HaBayit. And there, when they would see where the temple stood, they would rend their garment. Rashi, in his commentary to Masechet Pesachim, says Tzofim was a village. It was a place where one could see the Makom HaMikdash. Okay, is it Har HaTzofim? Could be. Not so clear. So the Braita says one rends for the Mikdash and one rends for Yerushalayim. Now, the Braita just told us that when you already rend for the Beit HaMikdash, Mosif al Yerushalayim, you just have to add a little bit for Yerushalayim. And here this implies that you rend again for Yerushalayim. Okay? And the Gemara answers lo kasha, it's not a question. Had depaga b'Mikdash b'Reisha, had depaga b'Yerushalayim b'Reisha. In one situation, that's where, in the first case, for instance, that's where you encounter the Beit HaMikdash first, the Makom HaMikdash first. You see the place where the temple stood in a state of ruin. And that's when you rend for the Makom HaMikdash, and then you add a little bit, Mosif Goshel, on Yerushalayim. Why? Because you've already torn for the Mikdash, okay, and that is more chamur, that is more significant or serious, and so you only need to add a little bit for Yerushalayim. But when do we say that you have to rend fully for Yerushalayim? That's had depagav Yerushalayim bereisha. That's when you encounter Jerusalem first. Okay, so what we would say here is when one, just to give you a little sikum, a little summary of the sugya here. When one encounters the Arei Yehuda, the cities of Judah, one would rend their garment, okay, rend a tefach like one would for a member of their family, one of their krovim, a tefach about 4 inches. And then when one encounters Yerushalayim, one would again rend their garment. And then when one would encounter the Makom HaMikdash, one would again rend their garment. However, if one has already rent his garment for the Makom HaMikdash, so then he only has to add a little bit for Yerushalayim. He doesn't have to make a new tear. As one would, you know, Shalom Eidah, Rahman al Tzlan, one makes a new tear. If one is already, let's say, in mourning for one of their relatives, and then they hear the news of another relative, they tear again. Okay, so the Gemara asks the question, well, you know, how do we understand this Braita versus this Braita? So you guys, well, how can one encounter the Makom HaMikdash first without encountering Yerushalayim? Normally you see Jerusalem and then you see the Makom HaMikdash. So Rashi explains maybe a person's coming, you know, in a wagon, let's say the windows are closed. The person's traveling and they don't see Yerushalayim until they first see the Mikdash. Okay, so then they tear first for the Mikdash. The Rambam explains simply that maybe one's traveling from the east. So they see the place where the temple stood first before they see Yerushalayim. Okay. The central question, of course, and we'll get to that in a moment, is how we define Churban. But before we get there, I'll just show you the Shulchan Aruch here in source number 3. He brings us down lahalacha. This is the halacha. It's at the end of Hilchot Tisha B'Av, together with these constant customs of mourning that are observed. For instance, one has to leave an area in their home unpainted or unfinished as a zecher l'churban. Other customs that Chazal instituted to constantly mourn the loss of Jerusalem and the Holy Temple, constantly mourn the churban. So Shulchan Aruch brings us down lahalacha, and he rules as we just said. You know, one who encounters the Arei Yehuda, they say this verse and they tear. One who encounters Yerushalayim, they say this verse, they tear. One who encounters the Makom Mikdash says this verse and they tear. And here, as we just said, bad derech hamidbar. Like the Gemara just said, if he first encounters the Mikdash, let's say he's coming from the Midbar, the Shulchan Aruch is basing this on the Rambam, he tears for the Mikdash, a Tefach, and then he adds for Yerushalayim, Kol Shehu, just a little bit, because the Mikdash is more significant. Okay, and then he continues to see Gimel. Im kara al achat me'ar Yehuda, eino chozer v'kore kishire, shara ar Yehuda chutz Yerushalayim. Shechozer v'kore ale, Kera acher bifnei atzma. Right? If he sees one of the Arei Yehuda, he rends his garment. If he sees another of the Arei Yehuda, he no longer has to tear. He already tore for the Arei Yehuda. If he encounters Yerushalayim, oh, he has to tear. Why? Because Yerushalayim is more significant than the Arei Yehuda. The Yerushalayim is holier than the Arei Yehuda. Okay? Ve'im kara al Yerushalayim enot tzarich likroa al shar Arei Yehuda. And that's important. We're going to come back to that point. If he already tore for Yerushalayim, he doesn't have to tear for any of the other Arei Yehuda, the cities of Judah. Why? Because Yerushalayim is one of the Arei Yehuda. It's the greatest of the Arei Yehuda. Okay? It's the capital. We're going to come back to that. And then, like the Rambam rules, the Shulchan Aruch sees it as a full comparison to a parent, not just with regards to how one is to repair the tear, but the korea al ksuto she alav ad shegalet libo, right? He has to expose his heart, okay? Again, without getting too lost in that, that's based on the Rambam, as I mentioned, is machloket between the Rambam and the Ravid and the Ramban as to how to interpret this braita, this sugya, whether it's a full comparison to one's parent or whether it's a limited comparison just to sewing it up. But like the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch takes that more expansive view and sees it as a full comparison. But how do we define Churban? You know, I once spoke about this and someone knowing I live in Har Nof asked, well, is Har Nof considered a Churban? I said, well, you know, I don't know if you come into my building, maybe. How do we define Churban, destruction or ruin? We said that if you see the Arei Yehuda, the cities of Judah, or Yerushalayim or Makom HaMikdash in a state of Churban, you have to rend your garment. How do we define Churban? What does Churban mean? Okay. And are we in a state of Churban today with the miracle that is the modern state of Israel? Yes, with all of its issues, with all of its problems, without getting to them this morning. But are we still in a state of Churban with the Hakamat HaMedina, with the founding of the state of Israel? We have a state, Baruch Hashem, we have Jewish sovereignty. That's the question. Or do we say, no, we still are in Churban. We don't have a Beit HaMikdash. Okay. So take a look at source number 2. This is the Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef defines what Churban is. And first he says, V'hai Arei Yehuda b'Churbanan, t'kamar d'hainu shehen charevot, v'ein bahen yishuv klal. He says, you know what Churban means? There is no yishuv. There are no Jews living there. Maybe there are a few scattered Jews. You know, the Ramban in his famous letter describes how he encountered just 2 Jews in Yerushalayim when he visited, right? There's not a yeshuv. There's not a settlement. That's Churban. Shehen charevot. Ve'en bahen yeshuv klal. Aval im yesh bahen yeshuv, he says, af al pi shehen bidei goyim, hayan nireh lichora de'en tzerich likroa. He says, you know what? maybe if there's the issue of if there's Jewish settlement, if there's a presence in the land, even if the land is under the hand of a foreign nation, even if it's not under Jewish sovereignty, if it's under, you know, the Ottomans, the British, but there are Jews living here. So maybe ain't tzarich likra, maybe you don't have to rend your garment anymore. He's not saying that churban is literal destruction, but he's saying that churban means that there's a Jewish presence. That's enough to obviate the obligation or to exempt one from the obligation of rending his garment. Okay, that's his first definition. Now, it's interesting. That definition, he doesn't cite the Kaftor Vaterach, but he's really borrowing it from the Kaftor Vaterach, Ishtoria Parchi, that's the pen name of this Rav Yitzchak HaKohen, who is a big scholar and lives in the 13th to the 14th century, and very, very unique individual. He writes this work, Kaftor Vaterach, on the geography of the land of Israel and on the laws related to the land of Israel, the mitzvot hatliyot ba'aretz, very important work. And there he defines churban as the absence of a Jewish settlement. Should the area be settled, one would be exempt from rending his garment. So that's this first definition. So the Beit Yosef first accepts this definition, but then he continues, and you'll see what he writes. He continues here, the efshar, but perhaps but you know, perhaps even if there is Jewish settlement, even if there's Jewish life, even if this is after the first Aliyah and the second Aliyah, right? Nevertheless, all the while that there's no Jewish sovereignty, all the while that the land of Israel is under foreign hands, under foreign rule, it's called churban. It's called destruction. And then he concludes, v'chein ikar. And that is the ikar. That is the essential or the main way of viewing this. And that second definition of the Beit Yosef is the one that is accepted by the majority of poskim. Okay, the majority of the poskim accept the Beit Yosef's definition of churban. That churban is really about sovereignty. And when there is no Jewish sovereignty, the Ari Yehuda and Yerushalayim and the Mekom HaMikdash are considered in a state of Urban, and one has to rend his garment. That's adopted by the Bach and by the Taz, the Magen Avram, and the Pata Shulchan and Mishnah Brura here. I put down in source number 4 and 5 the Magen Avraham. Magen Avraham writes, Afa Pishu Yoshvin Bahem Yisrael, even though there are Jews living there. If there are Gentiles, if there's a foreign rule that are ruling over them, even though they're Jews that are living there, that is called churban. And the Mishnah Berurah, here in source number 5, adopts that definition as well. Okay, so what's interesting is following the miraculous birth of the state of Israel, a number of authorities ruled that one is no longer obligated to rend his garment when seeing the cities of Yehuda and Yerushalayim, because here we have Jewish sovereignty, okay? We have a Medina with all of its problems. There was a big debate. Some, however, questioned whether a secular state not governed by Jewish law could indeed be considered a Jewish sovereignty. Well, throughout Jewish history, we had sovereignties that were not so perfect, as you well know. The Chashmonaim, for instance, we once spoke about the Chashmonaim. We saw an interesting tshuva of Rav Kook, how with all their problems, Rav Kook sees the Chashmonaim as a paradigm for creating a modern Jewish sovereignty in our ancient homeland. But the controversy, however, would remain dormant for another 19 years as the Are Yehuda and Yerushalayim, or at least the old city Yerushalayim, was captured and remained under Jordanian control until June 1967. But following the dramatic events of the Six-Day War, once again, Poskim asked this question. Is it required to perform Kriya upon seeing the cities of Yehuda and Yerushalayim and the Makom HaMikdash? Or is Harabayit Biyadenu? You know, now these These sites are under Jewish sovereignty. Maybe that obviates the need to rend one's garment. Maybe one is no longer obligated if we're defining Korban as a lack of Jewish sovereignty. Okay? So what's interesting, we'll just look at this very quickly. You know, it seems that the custom to rend one's garment for the Arei Yehuda, and even for Yerushalayim, fell out of practice. Specifically, the Arei Yehuda, you have it mentioned by the Radbaz, Rabbi David, Ibn Zimra, Ibn Shlomo, Ibn Shlomo, Ibn Zimra, who lives in the 16th century, was a rabbi in Sfat and in Yerushalayim, and before that in Egypt, as well as the Chida, who lives in the 18th century. So they mention, as well as others, that people are not rending their garment when seeing the Arei Yehuda and even Yerushalayim. Now, it was explained, Yerushalayim, you know, people who lived there saw the Churban, they lived with the Churban, and the din is, we didn't look at it together in the Shulchan Aruch, but the Shulchan Aruch rules that one who sees these places once in 30 days does not have to rend his garment. You only have to rend your garment if you encounter these places once in 30 days. If you're living in Yerushalayim and constantly seeing the Churban, you don't have to rend your garment at all. So it's possible that that's why that became the practice. But the Arei Yehuda, you know, it's not so clear why that fell out of practice. I put a passage from the Sefer Ir HaKodesh VaHamikdash, a very important work on the laws of Yerushalayim, a lot of fascinating discussions of Yerushalayim, written by Rabbi Yechiel Michal Tukuchinsky. Okay, he was famous for writing the Gesher HaChaim, but he wrote, you know, other Sfarim as well, and was a big, big Talmud Chacham who lived here in Yerushalayim in the 20th century. In fact, here in the Sefer, he's dealing with a lot of questions about Yerushalayim on a theoretical basis. He's writing before the Six-Day War. He passed away in the 1950s, and in the introduction to the work, his son writes, well, you know, halavai, if my father would only see the miraculous occurrences, the miracle of the reclamation of Yerushalayim and the Harabayat, all of a sudden, a lot of things he's writing about, in theory, are now questions halacha lemaaseh. In any case, he writes, here, I'll just summarize it for the sake of time. Tukuchinsky is defending why it fell out of practice to rend for the Arei Yehuda. He says, first of all, it's difficult to define the Arei Yehuda. We're not sure exactly which cities were part of the Arei Yehuda, and if those cities today are sitting on, let's say, their ancient locale. That's, you know, that's when he's writing, maybe in the 1950s. It could be that today with archaeology, we might have a better idea of where the ancient cities stood. But what he's saying is it's very difficult to locate and identify these cities. Others mention that, you know, Hebron, it's not clear if Hebron was one of the Arei Yehuda, Hebron was one of the Arei Miklat, so the status of Hebron is questionable. But you could say, you know, Beit Lechem, if a person, you know, visits Beit Lechem or sees Beit Lechem, today you can't visit Beit Lechem, right? But, you know, if you would see Beit Lechem, you're going to Kever Rachel, maybe you should rend your garment. So he writes that, you know, he's been malamid zchut. He's defending how the custom developed not to tear. He says, we don't really know exactly where these ancient cities are. It's difficult to define them. And then he makes another point, which is important, and it's really based on what we saw previously. He says, and the truth is most people coming, he's, you know, let's say writing in the 1950s, there's most people coming, this is certainly the case in the early 20th century, they're first coming to Eretz Yisrael. He writes, through Yafo and Haifa, they're coming through the port cities, and then they're first going to Yerushalayim, and only maybe later encountering the Arei Yehuda. They're first encountering Yerushalayim, and as we explained, if one sees Yerushalayim and already rends for Yerushalayim, that exempts him from rending for the Arei Yehuda, because Yerushalayim is one of the Arei Yehuda. It's the greatest of the Arei Yehuda. If you've already rent your garment for Yerushalayim, you need not rent for the Arei Yehuda. It's similar to this case when someone encounters the Mikdash first, the Makom Mikdash, the place where the temple stood, and only then gets to Yerushalayim. He only has to add a kol shehu, a little bit. So in this case, he doesn't have to tear at all. And so that Rav Tukuchinsky here defends how the practice developed. He says, you know, most people first encounter Yerushalayim before visiting the Arei Yehuda. Okay, so that's an interesting idea. Now, why did our sages institute rending for the Arei Yehuda? We understand why our sages instituted rending for Yerushalayim, for the destruction, rending one's garment when seeing the holy, the site of the holy temple in a state of Churban. But why for, you know, the Arei Yehuda, the cities that were in the biblical portion of the tribe of Judah, as opposed to other Israeli cities? One could argue that witnessing any city in a state of Churban should require one to rend his garment, right? So the Bach explains that the cities of Judah have greater importance than other cities of Israel. What that means is not so clear. Maybe they have a greater kiddushah. It seems to be that that's the position of the Levush. The Levush writes that it's due to their proximity to Yerushalayim, which makes them unique. Again, maybe they share some of the kiddushah of Yerushalayim. But I think the best pshat is the Pa'at HaShulchan, which is a work that was written by, I have it right here, written by one of the students of the Gaon Mivilna. And he writes that the cities of Yehuda are unique because they were the seat of the monarchy of Malchut Yisrael. And that makes a lot of sense because their destruction represents, right, the destruction of Malchut Yisrael. And if we define that Churban is a lack of Jewish sovereignty, so it would make sense that there's a requirement to rend one's garment for the Arei Yehuda, which represent Malchut Yisrael, which represent the seat of the monarchy. Lo yasur shevet miYehuda, the scepter shall never leave the tribe of Judah. The Melech Yisrael, the king, has to come from the tribe of Judah. Okay, has to come from, of course, David HaMelech, but from the tribe of Judah. So it makes sense that we tear for the Arei Yehuda because their destruction is destruction of the Malchut Yisrael. It reinforces the idea that it's sovereignty or the lack thereof that defines Churban. So again, coming back to the question, well, what happens after 1967 when there is seemingly Jewish sovereignty over the Arei Yehuda? Okay, so Rav Moshe here, in source number 6, writes, yes, indeed, after the miracles of the Six-Day War, we no longer have an obligation to rend one's garment. One has no longer an obligation to rend their garment when witnessing the Arei Yehuda, because they are now under Jewish sovereignty. Ach masig de ikar de kol shehem bidei akum. Af al pi sheyesh behem yishuv, bechurban an mikre. Right? We conclude, as we said, that all the while they're under Gentile hands, they're under foreign rule, right? Even though there is Jewish settlement, they are called Churban. They are called in a state of Churban. They are called in a state of destruction, okay? So he writes, okay, v'chulei. I'm just skipping for the sake of time, and this is the key line here. Okay. But now, Baruch Hashem, the Arei Yehuda and Yerushalayim are in Jewish hands. There's Jewish sovereignty. The Hem Gam Yushavim, and they are also settled. By the way, there are some poskim that say maybe we require both. Maybe we require both settlement and sovereignty to exempt one from having to tear. Okay, but Rav Moshe writes, "Hutam gadol shel likra." This is a very good reason not to rend one's garment. Af shadayin lo ba'gula al yedei melech ha-mashiach. Even though the final redemption has not come through the King Mashiach, ve'anu mitpachadim me'omot. And even though we are afraid of the nations, meaning even though there's a, you know, we have a constant, we live in constant fear of attacks, of war, even though we're constantly, you know, in this existential threat for our very existence, terror from within, violence from within and from without, he writes, nevertheless, in Likroa, you don't have to rend for the Arei Yehuda and for Yerushalayim. Okay, so that's interesting. The question ultimately becomes, well, you know, what about post-Oslo? We'll visit that in a moment. You know, once certain cities like Beit Lechem, certain cities in Yehuda, where at least the administration of such cities were given over to the Palestinian authorities. Does that now change the status? Okay, we never formally annexed Yehuda and Shomron, right? It's actually al haperek. This is very relevant today. This question is very relevant, right? We question whether one has to rend following the Six-Day War, when these cities are now in our hands, or at least no longer under foreign occupation or foreign sovereignty. But you could ask, well, were they ever really under Jewish sovereignty? And certainly after Oslo, when the administration of a lot of these cities was given over, Areas A, for instance, given over to the Palestinian Authority, right? Is that called a lack of Jewish sovereignty, which maybe once again would require us to rend? Okay, interesting. And then now, what if we formally annex such cities? Now, would that once again reverse the psak? We'll mention that in a moment. We'll visit that in a moment. It's an interesting question. Interesting how the political reality impacts on the halakha here. Well, we just saw Rav Moshe rules that following the miraculous events of the Six-Day War, one no longer need rend his garment upon seeing the cities of Judah and Jerusalem, because they are no longer in a state of korban. There's Jewish sovereignty. Okay. Now, with regards to Yerushalayim, it was actually a big machloket. And not everyone agreed with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, for instance, felt that, you know, since Yerushalayim has many Gentile houses of worship, churches, mosques, etc., Gentile graves, and there's a foreign culture, right? There's a foreign culture that permeates the holy city of Jerusalem. He said it's considered korban, and one should continue to rend their garment for Yerushalayim, even following the Six-Day War. So that's interesting. That's interesting. It's interesting because it would seem that the criteria is sovereignty. If we paskin like the Beit Yosef, if we accept the definition of the Beit Yosef, that korban is lack of sovereignty, lack of Jewish sovereignty, It doesn't seem like it has to do with having churches and mosques in Jerusalem, okay? However, you know, maybe for Rav Shlomo Zalman, no. The fact that there are these things in Jerusalem, there are, you know, houses of worship and Gentile graves, and there's a Gentile culture and Christianity and other religions, etc. Maybe that expresses that there is not real sovereignty, that political sovereignty for Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is not called sovereignty. That's not enough of sovereignty. You actually need more than just political sovereignty, but you need, let's call it, spiritual sovereignty. It's not enough just to have a medina. You have to have Malchut Yisrael with, you know, with a government that is doing things according to halakha, with a state, a spiritual state that is according to our Torah. And so it's interesting how he relates to the spiritual state of the city of Yerushalayim concerning this issue, not unlike we mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we discussed changes that were made post Six-Day War to the Tefillah of Nachem, which we add at Mincha on Tisha B'Av. We saw rich discussion amongst the various contemporary poskim, and we saw the opinion of Rav Unterman, who also, you know, looked at the spiritual state of Yerushalayim and the fact that there are still, you know, Gentile houses of worship, churches and mosques that are flourishing in Yerushalayim, while in his day there were many shuls that were still in states of disrepair. And so he said, we can't make changes to Nachem because Yerushalayim is still desolate and destroyed and it's still in a bad state. Again, looking at the spiritual state and how that impacts the spiritual reality, how that impacts on the halakha and these changes to these halachot. Okay? Or for instance, as we mentioned last week, we saw a tshuva, or part of a tshuva, from Rav Yaakov Ariel in his Bo'ala Shel Torah, where he also writes that, you know, there was a discussion and debate we saw last week about getting rid of the Arbat Somot altogether with the new reality of a state of Israel and Jewish sovereignty, or post Six-Day War with Yerushalayim and the Temple Mount in our hands. You know, should we still observe these fasts? So Rav Ariel, as we saw, also examines the spiritual state of the modern state of Israel. Okay. Others argue that we should still rend when seeing Yerushalayim, given the fact that the Holy Temple is not standing, and all the while that the Holy Temple is not standing, that impacts on Yerushalayim. Okay, this was the position of Rav Sraya Diblitsky. It was nifter not so long ago. He passed away not so long ago. It was a huge Talmud Chacham, lived in Bnei Brak, wrote many, many Sfarim. So he wrote that one should be stringent and rend his garment, even post Six-Day War, when seeing the old city of Jerusalem, because all the while that there's not a Beit HaMikdash, so Yerushalayim is in a state of korban. So what does that exactly mean? So I think the best pshat as to how to understand that is the pshat that we've already mentioned in previous weeks of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik drew on the Rambam. The Rambam, in his Perush HaMishnah, in a number of places, defines Mikdash, when the Mishnah, in a number of places, talks about the temple, or the temple confines, according to the Rambam, in his Perush HaMishnah, that includes Jerusalem as well. It's not limited to the temple confines or the Temple Mount, but it also includes the city of Yerushalayim. So Rav Soloveitchik explained that Yerushalayim shares its sanctity from the Beit HaMikdash, okay? It's included by the Rambam when he defines Mikdash in his Perush HaMishnah as not just the Makom Mikdash, but also Yerushalayim. So therefore, that includes Yerushalayim. So one, without a holy temple standing, even with Jewish sovereignty on Yerushalayim, even with a unified city, one should still rend his garment. His Talmud Mufak, Rav Herschel Schechter, writes that, nevertheless, Mechilat Kvodo, he cites his Rebbe, but nevertheless, he writes in Dikvei Atzon, that the custom is not to rend today for Yerushalayim, as we follow the lenient opinion in matters of mourning. The Gemara says in a number of places, halacha kidivrei ha-mekil be'evel, that when it comes to avilut, mourning, we are mekil, we are lenient. Now, there are those who argue that, yeah, but that doesn't apply to rending one's garment. Avilut l'chud and kriya l'chud. Maybe rending one's garment is different than mourning, bichlal. Okay, in any case, this is what Rav Schechter writes. We are mekil, and even all due respect to his teacher, who ruled that today we should still rend when seeing Yerushalayim. Rav Schechter ruled that the custom is not to rend for Yerushalayim. So today you have some that do and some that don't. Okay, now what about the Har HaBayit? Okay, so, that famous battle cry of Matagur, Har HaBayit Biyadenu, Temple Mount is in our hands, is forever etched into our collective consciousness. Right? The imagery and sounds of those fateful days in 1967, they still resonate with us today. So the question rose whether to rend for the Temple Mount, as suddenly the Makom HaMikdash is under Jewish sovereignty. Okay, again, we'll come back to this question in a moment, but is it really? You can maybe punctuate that battle cry, Har HaBayit Biyadenu, with a question mark. Is Har HaBayit still in our hands? Very quickly, the keys were turned over to the Waqf, as we mentioned in previous classes. So take a look here at a tshuva from Rav Mordechai Fogelman. Rav Mordechai Fogelman, he was the rabbi of Kiryat Motzkin and was a member of the Council of the Chief Rabbinate. He was a very important rabbi and leader in the 20th century here in the state of Israel. He was the uncle to former Chief Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, and he was the one who raised Rabbi Lau and his brother when they were liberated from Buchenwald and they made their way to Israel. He was raised in the home of Rav Fogelman, and in his memoirs, which I recommend everyone read, it's really beautiful. Published, his book has been published both in Hebrew and in English. He writes just how important Rav Fogelman was to his development and how he raised him like a father, and how he ultimately was the one who inspired him to enter the rabbinate and become a rabbi. So he describes, just for the sake of time, I'm going to summarize. He describes here in this tshuva, which is in Beit Mordechai, Chelek Aleph, Simon Lamed Gimel, how that right after the liberation of Yerushalayim and the Kotel and the Temple Mount, it was on Zion Sivan, the seventh of Sivan, right after Shavuot, right? This is Isru Chag, the day after Shavuot. And there was a Kenes Rabbanim, there was a conference of rabbis at Heichal Shlomo in Yerushalayim. So they all went together to visit the newly liberated Kotel. This is, again, just weeks, right? Days, really, after the liberation of the Kotel. They went and they visited, and there's all sorts of wonderful stories of that first Shavuot by the Kotel, and stories of that first Tisha B'Av at the Kotel, at the Temple Mount following the liberation. So here he's describing how they all went, and there were these big Talmidei Chachamim and these great rabbis that began to do what we just saw, recite this verse from Yeshayahu, rend their garment and cry and weep and mourn. And Rifoklin writes that he doesn't understand this. He couldn't comprehend this. Right? He says, we should be celebrating. We should be singing Hallel. Right? He says that we should make the bracha of Shehechianu b'shem u'malchut, with God's name. And he says, this is what he did. He says at the time it was a spontaneous decision, and then ultimately he revisited the sugya and went through the halacha and decided that that's the appropriate response. That once Yerushalayim and Harabayit are in Jewish hands and under Jewish sovereignty, it's not appropriate to mourn anymore. It's not appropriate to rend one's garment. One must celebrate and give thanks to God, he writes. Okay? And that's how he concludes his tshuva. He writes, again, we define Churban as a lack of Jewish sovereignty. Well, here, all of a sudden, after 2,000 years, we have Jewish sovereignty once again. Okay? So, and then he cites a number of opinions. There was a whole debate in the religious Zionist newspaper Hatzofet. They went back and forth. Like we saw with regards to making changes to the Tefillah of Nachem, there were debates in Hatzofet. Similarly, there were debates with regards to rending one's garment, articles of Rav Tzviuda Cohen Cook and Rav Shlomo Gorin. And he cites Rav Gorin that it's not appropriate now. He writes that, here, I'll just highlight at the bottom. He cites Rav Gorin, says, "Ein makom b'shat simcha ilayit kazot shezachinu la acharei alpayim shana shel churban, galut v'shoah, larbev et hatuga v'et ha'evel l'toch ha'simcha." He says, it's not appropriate. There's no place during this tremendous celebration and joy and gladness that Baruch Hashem, we are fortunate after 2,000 years of destruction and Churban and exile and Shoah, Holocaust. It's not appropriate to mix the expression of joy together with expressions of mourning by rending one's garment. That together we're going to say Shechianu and celebrate, and then we're going to rend our garment on the Churban Beit HaMikdash. It's not appropriate. However, Rav Moshe, here in that tshuva that we saw, who ruled that one no longer has to rend their garment for the Arei Yehuda in Yerushalayim, Rav Moshe and many others ruled that for the Makom HaMikdash, one still must rend his garment. Aval kishroeh Makom HaMikdash, shadayin hu b'churbeno. When one sees the place where the temple stood, that's still in a state of Churban. For Rav Moshe, Churban here concerning the Temple Mount is not an issue of sovereignty, but it's an issue of there's no Beit HaMikdash standing. Velo shayach shebaneh, and it's not shayach that it's going to be built El Yadei Melech HaMashiach, unless the Mashiach comes. It's only going to be built by the Mashiach, Rav Moshe writes. It's subject to debate. There is an idea, there's an opinion that first the temple will be built and only then the Mashiach will come, or that the temple can be built before the Mashiach comes. In any case, Rav Moshe assumes that only the Mashiach can build a temple. He writes, Tzarich likra b'pshitut, simply one has to rend his garment because the temple is not standing. In other words, it has nothing to do with Jewish sovereignty. And actually, I think that Rav Moshe's opinion makes a lot of sense defining Churban vis-a-vis the Mikdash or the Makom Mikdash differently, because if you take a look carefully at the Beit Yosef, whose definition we adopt, the Beit Yosef is actually here in source number two defining Churban as a lack of Jewish sovereignty, but he's defining it vis-a-vis the Arei Yehuda and maybe Yerushalayim as well, but he's not explicitly relating to the Makom Mikdash. So it could very well be that the Makom HaMikdash has a different definition of Churban. That Churban is a lack of Jewish sovereignty, maybe that's concerning the Arei Yehuda and Yerushalayim. But the Makom HaMikdash, the place where the temple stood, we don't define Churban as a lack of Jewish sovereignty. We define Churban as a lack of a temple. Okay? So I think Rav Moshe Feinstein's definition of Churban vis-a-vis the Makom HaMikdash makes a lot of sense if you go back and carefully read the Beit Yosef. That's something I wrote when I published on this topic in the Torah Journal Chakira. I think that's an important point. But it wasn't just Rav Moshe who believed that one still has to rend his garment following the Six-Day War when witnessing the Makom HaMikdash. As we saw, there were those like Rav Fogelman and Rav Tzviuda Cohen Cook and Rav Shlomo Gorin. By the way, there's a debate among the students of Rav Tzviuda whether he ultimately went back on that decision, or even until his death, he ruled that when one sees the Makom Mikdash, the place where the temple stood, he no longer has to rend his garment. It's a dispute amongst his students. They published on this as to what exactly was his opinion. It could be that he was Chozer Bo, that ultimately he went back once that initial euphoria of those days in June gave way to a stark reality. Once the Temple Mount was given over, or administration over the Temple Mount was given over to the Islamic Waqf. Rav Gorin, who here Rav Fogelman cites as ruling, like him, that one no longer has to rend his garment when seeing the Temple Mount, because it's in our hands. There's Jewish sovereignty. So Rav Gorin actually later retracts his ruling, again, when it became clear that the Temple Mount is not really under Jewish sovereignty, when the keys were given over to the Waqf. It's interesting. This recently they published a letter that was written by Rav Gorin to Moshe Dayan on this very issue. So Rav Gorin went back on his ruling and subsequently felt that, no, you know, maybe you know, you don't have to rend your garment for the Arei Yehudah and Yerushalayim, but you certainly do have to continue rending your garment for the Makom HaMikdash. So he ultimately changed his opinion like he did by Nachem. So we saw 2 weeks ago that initially he introduced changes to Nachem, but in the 70s, once he saw, you know, what happened following the Six-Day War and how things had changed and gave way to a stark reality, so he ultimately changed his position with regarding Nachem as well. Rav Avadya Hedaya ruled that, you know, if there was true sovereignty, then maybe that would obviate one from rending his garment. But it's not real true sovereignty. We need, he says, we need the meipara, the ashes of the red heifer. We need to be able to come on to Harabayit, since entrance to certain parts of Harabayit, certain parts are permissible even today, but certain parts of the Harabayit are prohibited without the Efer Para and without the Mashiach. So it's still not considered sovereignty. Again, he's, you know, like we saw before, he's looking at the spiritual state of the Temple Mount today. Not only the political state or the political reality, but also the spiritual reality. Rav Chaim David Halevi, who we already mentioned, he wrote that in theory one need not rend. He agreed with that position, that maybe one no longer need to rend when seeing the Makom HaMikdash nowadays, but he didn't want to rule. He said it requires a formal decision by the chief rabbi, which they never came to a formal decision on the topic. Okay, so today, you know, one can question whether there really is Jewish sovereignty on the Temple Mount. Things are a little bit better, but, you know, one ascending the Temple Mount where it's permissible, and it's a big machloket haposkim, whether it's permissible to go and where it's permissible to go, without getting into that topic. That's something that we'll have to explore another time. But they have to go up. They're first checked and examined, and they're told they can't pray, and they can't do this, and they can't do that, and they're followed by police, and they're followed by members of the Waqf, and up until recently, harassed by worshippers, Muslim worshippers on the Temple Mount. Okay, at times, even forbidden, told, no, you can't go up today. So you can question whether Harabayit is really Biadenu nowadays, or you can place a question mark at the end of that battle cry, the famous battle cry of Matagur. But again, you know, questions of sovereignty and control aside, many authorities rule that one is indeed obligated to rend his garment because Pashut, there's no temple, there's no Beit HaMikdash nowadays. That's the position that we saw of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and that's the position of many, many poskim. Without a Beit HaMikdash, you have to rend your garment. And so that's the custom. Is it observed by everyone? You know, unfortunately, people find all sorts of kunsim and patentim. They'll visit, for instance, on an Erev Shabbat, or they'll visit on Chol HaMoed or on Rosh Chodesh, and they'll say, oh, you know, these are happy days, or these are days when you don't mourn, or you're not allowed to do certain customs of mourning, at least. We don't say eulogies, for example. We don't eulogize on those days. So they say, oh, that obviates the need to rend. Other poskim say they don't like that, and they say, no, mapidom. On those days, one rends for a parent, you know, so that's the custom. Why wouldn't one rend his garment for the Holy Temple? You see that there's a comparison between rending for one's parent and rending for the Holy Temple. So one still rends on those days. It doesn't necessarily obviate the the requirement to rend. And they don't like people looking after these kunsim. The Gemara talks about one not rending his garment because he's wearing someone else's garment. It's a borrowed garment. If you're wearing your friend's shirt, you don't have to tear. Even if you hear about it, you know, Chas V'Shalom, one of your krovim passing away. So some, they pull the shtick where they say, okay, my clothes are yours, your clothes are mine. Again, to exempt them from having to rend, and other posts can take issue with that. And they say, you know, number one, they don't like that, and it's not nice. And number two, maybe it doesn't work. There's a lot of interesting material on that in the Achronim, in the contemporary poskim. And I think the point is, you know, if Chazal instituted this, you know, as an expression of grief and pain when seeing the place where the Holy Temple stood in a state of destruction, right, there's a mosque there, there's a shrine there. The Dome of the Rock is not really a mosque, but it's a shrine. Okay, maybe it's used as a mosque. But there's not a holy temple there. So, you know, that is cause to feel pain. That is cause to rend one's garment. And I mean, you know, Chazal instituted this as an expression of grief. I mean, if a person really feels for the Churban, and that's the Avodah, that's our obligation these days, the days that lead up to Tisha B'Av, and tonight, tomorrow, when we'll be mourning for the Holy Temple and tragedies that took place throughout Jewish history. So our avodah is to feel a real sense of pain. If one feels a real sense of pain for the Churban, so does a shirt really matter? Does a jacket really matter? Right? So in any case, but not everyone does this today, but that's the halacha one really should. Most poskim rule that even today with Jewish sovereignty, we still have to rend for the Temple Mount. Now, what about post-Oslo? So we saw, like, following the Six-Day War, yeah, Baruch Hashem, the Ari Yehuda and Yerushalayim and the Temple Mount are now under Jewish sovereignty. But post-Oslo, as we mentioned, certain cities and places in the West Bank were designated as Area A, Beit Lechem, for example, and are under the full administrative authority of the Palestinian Authority, okay? Even entry is prohibited to Israeli citizens. So a number of contemporary poskim, among them, Rav Schechter, we already mentioned this morning, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Nevin Sal, Rav Dov Lior, they ruled that since these cities are no longer under Jewish sovereignty, and again, the criteria is sovereignty. We said we accept the definition of the Beit Yosef, that Churban is a lack of Jewish sovereignty. Since these cities are no longer under Jewish sovereignty because control has been given over to the Palestinian Authority, a number of poskim, Rav Schechter, Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Nevin Sal, Rav Dov Lior, they ruled that, yeah, once again, there's an obligation to rend one's garment. So, you know, the ruling of Rav Moshe that we saw, which was written, I think, in 1981, Tafshim Emalef, that Chuba, that is no longer relevant post-Oslo, according to these poskim. It's interesting. Rav Eliyahu Bakshi Doron in a Chuba writes that, while Beit Lechem is not currently under Jewish sovereignty, right, it's Area A, nevertheless, the custom is not to perform Kriyat today, as we saw similarly, we saw that passage from Sefer Yir HaKodesh V'Migdash from Rav Tukachinsky, one typically visits Yerushalayim first, and then one goes to Beit Lechem, right? That's what one does. You first, you know, even when I've led groups of teenagers, you go right from Ben Gurion Airport to the Kotel. You take them first to Yerushalayim. So that, as we saw, if you've been to Yerushalayim first, that already obviates the need or exempts one from rending his garment for the other cities of Yehuda. Okay, in addition, he expresses concern, Eliyahu Bakshi Doron expresses concern for the prohibition of destroying property unnecessarily, the Isur of Baal Tashchit. The Gemara says that one who rends his garment unnecessarily for even a relative, if it's Yoter Midah, if it's too much, maybe it's a violation of Baal Tashchit. Or if he doesn't have to rend his garment for someone and he does, maybe it's a violation of Baal Tashchit. So we're meikil for the Arei Yehuda, even post-Oslo, writes of Eliyahu Bakshi Doron. Okay? But you can also argue that while Area A is under the Palestinian Authority's administration, maybe that's not necessarily called a lack of sovereignty. And Rav Avinair makes a distinction between autonomy and sovereignty, and suggests that while the Palestinian Authority may have autonomy, they don't have real sovereignty there in Area A. The Haraya Rav Avinair says that, for instance, the IDF can enter into Area A when necessary to carry out military operations. So you can question, you know, the status post-Oslo, is that called a lack of sovereignty? And it's not so clear. So Rav Avinair concludes that one is not obligated to rent for the Arei Yehuda, but if he wants to, he may do so. It's not an issue of Baal Tashchit. If he wants to, he may do so, but he's not obligated, given, you know, this gray area. Rav Lichtenstein also ruled that one's not obligated, but may do so as an expression of pain and anguish. In fact, in the Braita that we began with, we saw that one can rend his garment upon any expression of pain and anguish. When one hears Shmuot Ra'ot, bad news. And so the question in 2005, in August of 2005, was, you know, does one have to rend when one witnesses the destruction of Gush Katif, when one witnesses the Hitnatkut, the dismantling of a block of 17 Jewish settlements from Gush Katif? We'll be this summer remembering 15 years since the disengagement, you know, which evicted some 8,600 Israeli citizens from their homes. So there's a question, you know, should you tear Kriya? So the most glaring objection is, well, that's not part of the Arei Yehuda, although interesting, according to some authorities, we already mentioned, for instance, the Kaftor Vaferach this morning, this important work on the geography of Eretz Israel and the laws related to the land. So the Kaftor Vaferach actually rules that the Gaza Strip is indeed part of the biblical portion of Yehuda. Okay, and others, interestingly, explain that when the Braita is talking about the Arei Yehuda, the cities of Yehuda, maybe it's not specifically cities that were in the biblical portion of the tribe of Judah, but any area that was part of the kingdom of Yehuda, the Malchut Yehuda, the southern kingdom, okay, that began following that civil war described in Sefer Malachim, which we already mentioned this morning. So it's interesting. There are those who suggest that maybe we can define the cities of Yehuda as much broader than just actual Arei Yehuda, the cities that are in the biblical portion of Judah, but maybe it's any city that was part of Malchut Yehuda, okay? Or, as I said, there's this opinion that maybe even the portion of Yehuda extended to the Gaza Strip. Very, very interesting. So maybe there is an obligation to rend one's garment when witnessing the destruction, giving over sovereignty to the Palestinian Authority, to Hamas, okay? And then what happens if you visit this place subsequently, where you see Gush Katif? I don't know how close you can get. I don't think you could see any of the former Jewish settlements of Gush Katif. But there were poskim at the time that ruled that one should rend one's garment during the disengagement, either as an expression of one's grief, or maybe as an expression of seeing the Arei Yehuda in a state of Churban. Okay, very, very interesting discussion. And, as I said, this discussion is now relevant once again, okay? Once again, with the topic of annexation on the table. It's ala perek. It's halacha lemaaseh once again. And if the state of Israel pursues annexation of Yehuda and Shomron, or parts of Yehuda and Shomron, will this once again change the status? For those poskim who feel that post-Oslo, we have to rend again when seeing Beit Lechem, for instance, or cities that are in Arei Yehuda, maybe if Yehuda and Shomron are formally annexed, so that even according to those poskim would now once again exempt one from having to rend his garment. Very, very interesting question. And then this question, I think, expresses this very difficult place we find ourselves in today, as we've discussed in previous weeks, that, you know, Baruch Hashem, we've returned to the land of Israel. We have been zochet to build a state here. And we were zochet to witness the reclamation of Jerusalem and the Temple Mount, but we still mourn the absence of the Holy Temple, the Beit HaMikdash. That absence is glaring. That gives us what to think about. It's a cause for pause, and mourning is still very relevant. While there is this question, wow, Baruch Hashem, yeah, you know, wonders and miracles, nisim and niflo, we've been zochet. Nevertheless, at the same time, we're not there yet. We recognize how far we have come, and yet how far we still are. We live during confusing and challenging times, but also during exciting times. We live at a unique moment in history. By observing these customs of mourning that we've been looking at the last few weeks, may we merit to see the promise of Chazal, that all who mourn for Yerushalayim will merit to see her in her joy. I wish you all a tzom kal u'mo'il, an easy and meaningful fast. I'll take any questions.
Hello?
But any questions?
But we're not supposed to mourn excessively for relatives. So how come when it comes to the Beis Hamikdash, we're still allowed, not even allowed, but we're required to mourn?
Well, the difference is, it's a good point you raise, and it's a good question. The difference is that there's no Beit HaMikdash. So it's not that we're mourning excessively. Certainly, if someone would continue to mourn once the Beit HaMikdash would be rebuilt, once there's a final Geulah, okay, then they're doing the wrong thing. This is only when the Makom HaMikdash is a state in a state of Korban. As we saw this morning, there's a debate as to how to define a state of Korban. Once it's under Jewish sovereignty, is that still called Korban? Right? Or no, maybe it's in Jewish hands, it's no longer Korban. Or no, maybe it still is considered Korban where there's no Holy Temple standing. It's very glaring. There's no Beit HaMikdash there.
Okay. And in the present, in the beginning, how come they made cuts in their flesh?
Okay, so that's a longer discussion. It's not for now. We're out of time.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I just want to let you know that the source sheets were not on the screen. There was something else on the screen, and though I think you were looking at it and moving the cursor, but we were seeing something else that looked like some kind of ad.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, just to let you know for the future.
Thank you. The source sheets, I apologize. I was having some trouble with the Zoom. The source sheets will be available on the OU website. Okay, they will upload the source sheets, so everyone will have access to the source sheets.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. Okay, have a great day, everyone. And as I said, it should be an easy and meaningful fast, and we should be zochet to see B'mehera Yameinu, the final Geulah, speedily in our days. Take care.